This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the program. I'm Lawrence Eppard, and this is the Utterly Moderate Podcast. Before we get started, I want to say that, like many of you, I am deeply, deeply shaken by the terrorist attacks in Israel at the hands of Hamas. What I've read, what I've seen is beyond horrifying. It's the absolute worst of humanity. The murders and the sexual violence, it's really shaken me to my core, as I'm sure it has all of you. And I just pray for those individuals. I pray for their families and for their communities. And I don't have anything deeper or anything really unique or special to offer about this. I'm speechless. Like I said, this is the absolute worst of humanity. And I just pray for all those people. And I don't have any way to transition away from this to today's episode. And so, you know, forgive me for this really abrupt segue. You know, we'll try to have a podcast episode in light of all of this. On today's episode, we're going to return to the topic of misinformation and disinformation. So Lee McIntyre, who's a friend of the show and you'll probably know, is a frequent guest. He has a new book out on this topic titled On Disinformation, How to Fight for Truth and Protect Democracy. So McIntyre argues that there's an effort in our country to destroy facts and make America ungovernable. And he writes in this new book that this is a culmination of 70 years of strategic denialism. In the book, he does a variety of things. So he walks through how this war on facts began, talks about the bad actors who deny obvious realities, how they wield disinformation to manipulate us. But he also gives some hopeful messages about things that we can do, practical steps that we can use as ordinary citizens to combat all of this, and also what our government can do to fight what he calls this scourge of disinformation that is threatening the very fabric of our society. About the book, the publisher writes that, quote, it's a powerful pocket-sized citizen's guide on how to fight back against the disinformation campaigns that are imperiling American democracy, end quote. On Disinformation not only includes McIntyre's valuable analyses and commentary, but also includes interviews with leading experts on information warfare, counterterrorism, and political extremism. McIntyre says he wrote this book because, like me, he believes this is an urgent problem, and he hopes that he can empower us with tools and knowledge to help save our republic before it's too late. On today's episode, I'm going to play some highlights from a previous conversation that I had with McIntyre on this topic. You'll also note that Tom Nichols is a part of this conversation, the author of The Death of Expertise. Should be a good conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. When I talk to people about the problem of post-truth, one of the things they often say to me is, well, isn't this just something that we're naturally hardwired to have a problem with? Don't our brains want to keep out threatening information that makes us feel bad or that threatens our core beliefs or threatens our identities, etc.? And my response is, of course, yes, we do have those tendencies. They are hardwired, but our media ecosystem, our information ecosystems, they really determine how much those biases and those human tendencies are unleashed. So could we talk a little bit about about the hardwired tendencies?
Cognitive bias has been with us through the couple of hundred thousand years, I'm sure, of the evolution of our species. I mean, the Daniel Kahneman's brilliant book, Thinking Fast and Slow, you know, talks about all of these wired in mistakes that we make. And it's actually an interesting academic question why we have them. I mean, what's the survival value for making a mistake in reasoning? But for whatever reason, they're there. And they're there no matter what our political convictions are. Liberals and conservatives both have them. And so, you know, they're, as you say, Lawrence, they're wired in. People have been, and this is some pushback that I get on the concept of post-truth. Sometimes people will say, well, hasn't this always existed? You know, politicians have always lied. People have always lied. Yes, there's always been a certain amount of lying. And, you know, it's not that this was born in 2016, as I think I've indicated before. But what happened is it got worse because this predilection that people have to believe fake things when they hear them more than once, or when they hear them, you know, from multiple sources. You know, all of these wired in biases that we have are made much worse when they're amplified. And that's what social media has done. It used to be that, you know, these fringe conspiracy theories are, you know, were out there and somebody had to mimeograph them and hand them out on the sidewalk. Or if they could, you know, get it in a certain newspaper sold at the grocery store, you know, maybe the folks standing in line would, you know, would buy it. But now it's on the internet. And so what happens is people can get traction for any, just about anything that they think of.
Yeah, there's this great piece from The Bulwark from a couple of years ago from a great writer named Yevgeny Simkin. And he offers a valuable take on the rise of social media and its impact on our society. He wrote, quote, "Let's take a short walk down memory lane. It's 1995. A man stands on a busy street corner yelling vaguely incoherent things at the passerby. He's holding a placard that says, 'The end is nigh, repent.' You come upon this guy while out getting the paper. How do you feel about him? You might feel some flavor of annoyance. Most people would also feel compassion for him, as he's clearly suffering from something. No reasonable person would think of convincing this man that his point of view is incorrect. This is not an opportunity for an engaging debate. Now fast forward to 2020. In terms of who this guy is and who you are, absolutely nothing has changed. And yet here you are, arguing with him on the internet, on Twitter or Facebook, and you yourself are being brought to the brink of insanity. Social media is an insidious malware slowly corrupting our society in ways that are extremely difficult to quantify, but the effects of which are evident all around us. Anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, QAnon, cancel culture, Alex Jones, flat earthers, racists, anti-racists, anti-anti-racists," end quote.
The average person says, a good source is one that agrees with me and the things I already think. And a bad source is one that presents me with uncomfortable cognitive dissonance. And this kind of gets over into Lee's territory. A bad source is one that challenges my tribal political affiliations with information that makes me uncomfortable about those affiliations. You know, in some way, we're hardwired for two reasons. First of all, we know that physiologically, it feels bad to be wrong. We literally have a physical reaction to being wrong because it feels good to be right, because that's affirmation and, you know, it's self-confidence. And so there is an evolutionary basis. We're also hardwired to cooperate. So when enough people believe something, you want to believe it too, because then you're, you know, I mean, being the truth teller is being the uncomfortable skunk at the garden party. But this predates social media. And in Death of Expertise, I date this from maybe the late 60s or early 70s. What happened was not that people started to doubt experts. That's true. And that's always been the case. I mean, I tell stories in the book about no one ever likes professors. Professors have always had bad reputations, you know. I pointed out in the book that when I was a young, brand new assistant professor, I used to go down and hang out my, God rest his soul, my brother had a bar down in our very working class neighborhood in Massachusetts. And I'd go hang out with my brother. I mean, having a brother who owns a bar is a great thing, you know. And so I'd go hang out with my brother and I would leave. And this guy turns to my brother and he says, "So your brother's a professor?" And my brother said, "Yeah." And he said, "Huh, seems like he's a good guy anyway." Like that goes with the territory of where, you know, nobody likes exclusion, and knowledge by its nature, expertise and knowing stuff is exclusionary by its nature. What's different, and this is when we were all kind of talking in the pregame show here, when we were having a quick discussion, was what's different is this tidal wave of narcissism that starts to overtake us in the late 60s and early 70s. Where it's not just people saying, "I doubt experts." It's they're saying, "I am smarter than experts. I know this subject." What pushed me to write The Death of Expertise was not Trump or some political phenomenon. It's when I'm a Russia expert by training. I'm a Soviet guy. Speak Russian, been there dozens of times, studied in Leningrad, the whole nine yards, right? And a young guy says to me, because he didn't like something I was saying about Edward Snowden and Russia. And he said, "Tom, I don't think you understand Russia. Let me explain this to you. Let me explain Russia to you." And I finally just stopped and said, no, something is dysfunctional. I get paid for this. I'm an expert on this. And so that to me is the thing that is qualitatively new. And when I started doing interviews for The Death of Expertise, so doctors, for example, would say, "You know, I understand when people walk in and say, well, you're a quack. And I don't trust your diagnosis, and I'm going to get another opinion, and I'm not sure." Now they walk in, and he said, "What's this?" One doctor, a general practitioner, said, "What's really different now is they walk in and say, here's what's wrong with me, and here's what you're going to do." And people do this. I said, "Well, maybe that was a one-off. A surgeon, a pediatric surgeon in the Midwest, and I talk about this in the updated version. Here's the procedure we are engaging you for on our child. Like it's like interior decorating." And he said, "This is a very dangerous procedure." And the parents said, "No, we're not here to argue with you. We've done our research. We know what we want." That is the thing that I think, if you're out there thinking, well, this has just always been the case, and these are just pointy heads who don't like that people don't listen to them about everything, that's normal. It's the, "I know more about this subject than doctors or diplomats or arms control experts or neurosurgeons or whatever it is." I mean, it is really a remarkably, I mean, and you saw it in spades when Donald Trump became president. He goes to CDC and he says, "I know more than the doctors. They're amazed at how much I know. Everyone tells me I should have been a doctor." And millions of Americans said, "I totally get that guy. I totally understand this." So that to me is the thing I would argue that I think people should look at more closely is the almost, I had a high school teacher, my high school English teacher used to call it aggressive stupidity, that it's not just ignorance or a kind of failing. It's like this almost predatory ignorance that says, you know, in the overlap with Lee's is, I'm not just going to ignore the facts. I'm going to do violence to them because I know better. And that's the thing I think that's changed.
There's an aspect, Tom, that I think's important to recognize. So you talk about narcissism, and people tend to think, well, you know, that's just an individual thing, but it's heightened in the group, right? Because if you, through the amplification of disinformation on social media and elsewhere, if you can find other people who agree with you, then that makes it even more aggressive. That makes the person even more likely to say, not just "I know better than the experts," but "we know better than the experts," because they can find a bunch of other people who aren't experts either who agree with them.
I'm going to say a few things that'll probably aggravate a few folks out there. But a part of the problem is not with the media, it's with us. You know, why do we have these? And I've done it, right? I do TV. I've been one of the Brady Bunch, you know, 10 talking heads and all that. You know, why do we have these big gladiatorial arguments on television? I get asked this and I say, because that's what you want. Because, you know, I was on a panel one time with Dan Baltz from the Washington Post. And it was such a great moment because somebody stood up and kind of pointed the finger, said, "Why don't you guys, the Washington Post, you know, write more explainers and help us understand things?" And he said, "We do. You don't read them." Because, of course, in the modern era, I don't know if anybody's ever been, I'm obviously outside the panel here. if you've ever been in a modern newsroom, they know exactly what you're reading all the time. They have like these big electronic command centers. The guys in the Washington Post, the New York Times, they know what page most people are on. They know how long they dwell on an article. They know all this stuff. And he, without even blinking, Dan said, we do. We write them. You won't read them. And so the media, and this is kind of a weird road to go down for an old school, former, you know, market oriented conservative like me. But capitalism has created news as a product. And so we get what we want. We have information poisoning for the same reason that we are all, you know, overweight and diabetic, because we eat junk food because we like it. And that's what we want. And that's what the market provides to us. And so the one side, other side thing is partly to service our narcissism, to come back to that. It's like, well, they didn't represent somebody who has my view on it. Are they saying that my view isn't good enough? And instead of being courageous and saying, yes, that's right, your view is stupid, your view is crazy, you know, no, you know, the world is not flat. You know, they say, well, all right, we'll have it as a debate because everybody loves a debate. And it's also our false sense of egalitarianism, that we don't like to have anyone on who speaks authoritatively without being challenged, right? So somebody says the world is, you know, round. Well, who is this person to simply declare, like the Pope, you know, that the world is round? So we have to have one person who says, well, I am speaking for the common person, and maybe the world isn't round. And that makes us feel good. We sit back in our chairs and we say, see, somebody stuck it to that smarty pants. We lost our nerve somewhere. There's a loss of kind of virtue in all this. I gave a talk a while back to a committee at the National Academy of Sciences, and they said, what can we do about, you know, this post-truth problem? And I said, well, get out there and plant the flag. Stop arguing with people about the basic nature of reality. Say, look, I'm a Nobel Prize winning astrophysicist. I promise you the world is flat, is not flat, and I'm not going to argue about this. And they kind of all shook their heads and said, well, you know, nobody wants to be condescended to. And I'm like, okay, but, you know, if you're not going to defend these basic truths, then it's patronizing. I don't know what to do about that. So somewhere there's a sweet spot in between, you know, well, we all have opinions, and being overly authoritative. But I think that's what the media is doing. I think the media is saying, well, we don't want to offend anybody, so we have to have a variety of views, because there's going to be one crackpot who's going to, you know, be alien. And in a market where eyeballs are money, every set of eyeballs you fight for.
Lee, you have a great quote about the internet, about how there's all this information, just this sea of information on the internet. And much of it's really, really good, but you have to know what is good and what is not, or else you can really be lost. You say, quote, "The cognitive bias has always been there. The internet was the accelerant, which democratized all of the disinformation and misinformation and diminished the experts. This has led to the abandonment of standards for testing beliefs. It leads people to think they are just as good at reasoning about something as anybody else. But they're not. At the doctor's office, I don't ask for the data and reason through it myself and decide on the course of treatment. It takes expertise and experience to make that judgment. Just like I can't fly my own plane. There's a great scene in an Indiana Jones movie where he's in a room with all of these goblets and chalices and doesn't know which one is the Holy Grail. That's where we are right now. We have the truth right in front of us, but we don't know which one it is. There's a slogan that science deniers use: do your own research. If science is about facts, why can't I just go out and find my own facts? But you need guidance to know what is factual. You need experts." End quote.
People have said, well, look, the internet is wonderful because you can find truth. I mean, you don't need a World Book Encyclopedia anymore. It's all there. You can go out and find it. And it's true. If you're looking for truth, you know, if you're looking for well-vetted, you know, double-sourced things, you can find it. The problem is that it's cluttered with a lot of other stuff that you've got to be able to find your way through. And there's this wonderful scene where Indiana Jones, he's looking for the Holy Grail. That's, you know, title, the whole movie. And he's finally found it. And it's right in front of him with 99 fakes. He doesn't know which one it is. And that's what the internet is like. We've got true information at our fingertips, but we cannot discern the difference. It's another metaphor I talked about one time was when I was a little boy, you know, standing in line talking to my mom as we were checking out, you know, I'd see the National Enquirer and it'd have this scandalous headline. And I'd say, wow, mom, you know, look at that, aliens have landed. And she'd say, no, you know, that's the National Enquirer. And, you know, how do they get away with that? Well, you know, we probably talked about that a couple of times. But, you know, imagine you bought a copy of the National Enquirer and you bought a copy of the New York Times and you brought them home and you cut out all the articles and you made a collage and then you electronically altered the fonts so that it all looked the same and you presented all the articles side by side. You couldn't tell the difference. And that's what you see now on Facebook and Twitter. That's how people get their news. So they don't just get it from the traditional media sources. They get it as chopped up by social media that presents traditional news and a lot of fake news along the way, which is very tough. So, you know, Tom, your insight about expertise, I think, is really, you know, exactly spot on. And I think there's another problem, too, which is not only that people don't trust experts, they don't have the wherewithal sometimes to know who the experts are. It's like you were saying before about science. It's not just that they challenge scientific facts. It's they challenge the process by which scientific facts are discovered. They don't, it's the Dunning-Kruger effect, right? Too stupid to know they're stupid. They don't know. They have no context, no frame of reference to figure this out.
The other problem is that, again, I'm going to go back to this narcissism and egalitarianism theme. When students say to me, but the internet is information. It's free. It's like, it's a huge lie. It's the Library of Alexandria online. And I say, no, the internet is a giant dumpster. And I think sometimes students think I'm a Luddite, but I'm a techno optimist. I mean, the internet came of age. I'm 60 and the internet came of age when I did. I mean, I had my first email account in 1983, before people use that term, because I worked in a social science lab. Like, I was totally a nerd about everything related to computers, and I still am. I mean, I'm 60 years old and I'm still a computer gamer. Probably shouldn't admit that out loud, but I am. And so when I say, you know, they say, well, you hate the internet. I'm like, no, I hate anything that doesn't have gatekeepers, which is a word that triggers people. I'm like, I'm sorry, but I had a blog. I took it down because, as a student said to me, can I quote your blog? And I said, no, the editor's an idiot. And he said, and he kind of paused for a minute. I said, right, me, because you should never be your own editor. There is no control. And Lee, the thing you're getting to about the provenance of information, you don't even know, like, who the expert is. You know. So I said, if it doesn't have editors, if it doesn't have a corrections page, if it's not an established press, and I think the other problem with the internet as a source of information, it's not just, I love Lee's metaphor here of, you know, mix the fonts or standardize them, but also that we have come to believe that information is always interesting. And that if it's just information and it's boring, it's not true. And one of the gripes, when I said a minute ago, I was going to make people mad. One of the gripes I have about media, and this is, when I say I'm going to make people mad, I'm going to draw a comparison here between people like Tucker Carlson and Rachel Maddow, who used to be pals, because they present information in the same way. I am letting you into something very cool. I am here to tell you secret stuff I'm going to make you one of the initiates, one of the elect who understands. And the internet plays to that all the time. Because to simply hand somebody a gray, you know, newspaper with black and white type on it and say, this isn't news, this isn't interesting. And we've come to expect that information is this constant jolt of dopamine, because we expect that everything in the 21st century has to be a constant jolt of dopamine. And so the internet is the worst of all worlds in that way. And so I'm a huge favor of boring news and gatekeepers. And people, younger people especially, hate that because as someone said to me one time when I said this, so what you're saying is you're trying to defend the patriarchy. And I'm like, you know, the gatekeepers don't have to be all men, but they have to be somebody. And I don't know how we get back to that.
This is something I wrote in my forthcoming book, The Poisoning of the American Mind, which will be out in spring of 2024. I wrote this about cable news, quote, "Cable news is another place that will confirm extremely flawed ideas. To many viewers, cable news outlets appear to be legitimate news organizations that employ messengers who appear to be appropriately credentialed journalists. These channels then confirm the worldview of the viewer through stories they choose to cover, the ones they avoid, and the ways in which they frame their stories. Viewers grow to trust these outlets since the information they present makes the viewer feel good and is presented to them by seemingly credentialed and knowledgeable sources who belong to the viewer's tribe. But the journalistic standards of channels like Fox News, MSNBC, Newsmax, CNN, and One America News Network are nowhere near the same as they are at places like the Associated Press and Reuters. Relying on cable news means taking in a lot of faulty information, and most of us do not have the time, knowledge, or desire to figure out what is true and what is not." Commenting on the impact of cable news on our society, Ted Koppel wrote that, quote, "The commercial success of both Fox News and MSNBC is a source of nonpartisan sadness for me. While I can appreciate the financial logic of drowning television viewers in a flood of opinions designed to confirm their own biases, the trend is not good for the republic, beginning perhaps from the reasonable perspective that absolute objectivity is unattainable. Fox News and MSNBC no longer even attempt it. They show us the world not as it is, but as partisans at either end of the political spectrum would like it to be. This is to journalism what Bernie Madoff was to investment. He told his customers what they wanted to hear, and by the time they learned the truth, their money was gone." End quote. Cable news takes advantage of the audience's motivated reasoning and confirmation bias. As Koppel told Fox News' Sean Hannity directly, quote, "You've attracted people who are determined that ideology is more important than facts," end quote.
There's some empirical research which shows that people are more prone to believe a conspiracy theory if they think that it's unpopular. It's sexier when you're one of the initiates. You know, you've taken the red pill and you're one of the few people who really know the truth.
It occurred to me as I was watching, because I watch all of the cable networks, and it occurred to me that all of the cable networks had a similar, at least with the personality-driven shows, they had a similar MO. I am speaking directly to you, and you and I are going to learn cool stuff that no one else really understands, and I'm going to connect the dots. And you know, people, the idea that when the news, I'm old enough to remember when the news was, you know, 28 minutes. I'm not old enough to remember the nightly news. Younger people watching us will not believe this. The nightly news used to be 15 minutes long. That was it. And the other rest of the time, you had to read a newspaper. And the idea that you would just get a droning kind of recitation of, we signed an arms control treaty today, inflation is 2%, the unemployment rate spiked, that is inconceivable to the modern viewer. And so, yeah, and I think it just, it blends into this, because it's like, we must feel like we are being initiated into special knowledge. Somebody asked for an explanation of red pill from the Matrix, where if you take the red pill we're really all just living in a big computer simulation. But if you take this one pill, the red pill, you see it. Whereas if you take the blue pill, you get to live in, you know, the fantasy. And so to red pill somebody is like to give them the pill that clears their eyes and they see reality for what it is. And they suddenly realize that we're all living in the guts of this huge machine. And it's a completely paranoid, inane concept that came out of a science fiction movie that people now use unironically and without realizing how crazy it sounds.
The other aspect to this that is really quite shocking is to realize that there's a difference between misinformation and disinformation. A lot of the mistakes that you know people come up with are fed to them by somebody who intentionally created them and then amplified that counter narrative in any way that they could. And so, you know, I look at I study, you know, professionally. My next book is about how to talk to a science denier. I study science deniers. In many cases, they're victims. They're the audience. They're the pawns for people who are profiting either economically or politically or ideologically, who have created this enormous disinformation campaign that then they're feeding out because it serves their interests. And so, you know, it's not just that people are, you know, stupid for believing, you know, what they read. It's that somebody is creating this understanding exactly how the human mind works and what people will go for and what they won't. And what it really comes down to is information warfare.
You know, part of the social guardrails before the internet was, if you were that one guy in town who said, you know, I had a neighbor, I had an elderly neighbor who really believed all the lurid Inquirer stuff. Like every Sunday, my job for my neighbor was she was disabled, right? So every Sunday, little Tommy Nichols took his quarter in payment and I went down to the drugstore and I got her all her tabloids for the week. And she believed that, you know, there were graveyards full of Catholic babies that the priests had hidden, you know, and that the moon landing was fake and all that stuff. And what kept all that in check was that these people were embedded in an entire society of people who shook their heads and said, you know, that's not true. And if this is not going to be a thing. And what made it a thing was the ability to reach out each person who believes this. Now, you know, they create a union. And I'll give you an example of one of the ways I found this really unsettling. There is a group that formed over the internet that see themselves now as an interest group. They're a club nationally of people who have come to realize that they are the victims of constant government surveillance. Now, we would call those people emotionally disordered, paranoid, untreated schizophrenia, whatever it is. They were profiled in the New York Times as a social organization with pictures and a big, you know, journalist doing a big thing, where I'm reading it saying these are people who before the internet and before journalists could exploit this as a story, these are people who would have been the one person in town. There would have been an intervention to say, no, the government does not have cameras in the street lamps, you know, and in your TV and in your refrigerator watching you. And now it's mainstream. So my concern is that when we take all of these things, I'm leaving aside the mental illness problem, but when we take people who say, you know, flat earthers, or I'm trying to think of a less, you know, even QAnon, you know, that saying, well, we have to engage and we can't shun. I think that we deprive our fellow citizens of moral and intellectual cues that leaves them more aimless. I mean, sometimes even in a classroom where I hate to ever be directive because I teach politics. We give a lot of give and take. But there are moments when you have to bring everything to a kind of record scratch halt and say, I have to stop right here. That is wrong. That is simply not a factually true thing. We can talk about other stuff, but that's not. And I think we have to start doing that with our fellow citizens, because I take your point that left untended, it's like saying, well, there are weeds growing in my garden, and if I just give them a dirty look, they'll stop growing. On the other hand, you don't tend the weedy part of the garden and keep feeding it. And I'm going off the edge of a metaphor here, so I'll stop. But I'm just concerned about the reaching aside. I think the best thing a Nobel Prize winning scientist could do is come out and say, this is the world is not flat. It's the last thing I can say about it. I can't have this discussion. You know, I can't, because everything you know this, having dealt with these folks, and I've done it with political conspiracy theories, every argument becomes proof that the conspiracy is true.
That's right.
And that the more you argue, the more you become identified as an agent of the conspiracy, and that the effort you put into it validates their belief that they are important enough because they have discovered the truth. But if you spend 2 hours arguing with a conspiracy theorist, they say, you know what? Lee McIntyre spent 2 hours arguing with me. I am onto something. Whereas with some people, I have finally gotten to the point with people where I've said, you're not only wrong, but deep in your heart somewhere, you know you're wrong. And I can't get you there. That's a spiritual matter. That's a human or moral matter. And I cannot get you to where you need to be. You need more, but I'm not going to argue with you. You deep down, you know you're wrong. And it seems to have an effect, but I admit it's unscientific on my part. And I don't know what works. But I think engaging has been the way we do education and public debate for 40 or 50 years. And it's not working.
Mr. President, today was heartbreaking. And I was shaken to the core as I thought about the people I met in China and Russia and Afghanistan and Iraq and other places who yearn for freedom and who look to this building and these shores as a place of hope. And I saw the images being broadcast around the world, and it breaks my heart. I have 25 grandchildren. Many of them were watching TV, thinking about this building, whether their grandpa was okay. I knew I was okay. I must tell you as well, I was proud to serve with these men and women. This is an extraordinary group of people. I'm proud to be a member of the United States Senate and meet with people of integrity as we do here today. Now we gather due to a selfish man's injured pride and the outrage of supporters who he has deliberately misinformed for the past 2 months and stirred to action this very morning. What happened here today was an insurrection incited by the President of the United States. Those who choose to continue to support his dangerous gambit by objecting to the results of a legitimate democratic election will forever be seen as being complicit in an unprecedented attack against our democracy. Fairly or not, they'll be remembered for their role in this shameful episode in American history. That will be their legacy. I salute Senator Langford and Loeffler and Braun and Daines, and I'm sure others, who in the light of today's outrage have withdrawn their objection. For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen. The best way we can show respect for the voters who are upset is by telling them the truth. That's the burden. That's the duty of leadership. The truth is that President-elect Biden won the election. President Trump lost. I've had that experience myself. It's no fun. Scores of courts, the president's own attorney general, state election officials, both Republican and Democrat, have reached that unequivocal decision. And in light of today's sad circumstances, I asked my colleague, do we weigh our own political fortunes more heavily than we weigh the strength of our republic, the strength of our democracy, and the cause of freedom? What's the weight of personal acclaim compared to the weight of conscience? Leader McConnell said that the vote today is the most important in his 36 years of public service. Think of that. Authorizing two wars, voting on two impeachments. He said that not because the vote reveals something about the election, it's because this vote reveals something about us. I urge my colleagues to move forward with completing the electoral count, to refrain from further objections, and to unanimously affirm the legitimacy of the presidential election. Thank you, Mr. President.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again. Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together? Just sing the song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you.
Goodbye, good luck, and may the good Lord take a liking to you.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.